Hello, welcome to Diving Into the Wreckage, and Sean and I are here to talk about communization theory, an oft-confused, very confusing theory that we both have some historical connection to, and I've been accused of hating.
You've been accused of hating everything. If anything has come across your quantum, you have been accused of hating it, man.
That's true. And so I'm going to just start off with a bastardized Shakespeare appropriation. We have come not to praise communization, nor to bury it, just to explore it. And I'm going to start off with handing it to Sean about a definition, and then I'll talk about what I understand to be its historical trajectory. And then we'll both talk about how we ended up ever involved in the first place. So, Sean.
Good idea. I like this. And thank you for calling this this summit together. I wasn't sure it was a good time to praise, bury, mourn, or explore communization, but having got into pulled some books off my shelf that have been gaining dust, I think it is an interesting time. And it's an interesting time if only because especially for our younger listeners or for our newer listeners, both Varnvlog and Antifada, it's good, I think, for both of us to re-examine priors that we may have had in the past and sort of explore why it was that particular ideas at particular moments seem plausible. But with all that being said, I have here, for people who are watching this on Varnvlog here, you can see SICK 1, which was the International Journal for Communization. I think now defunct, but this was an attempt in 2011, right? So almost 14 years, 15 years ago, to try to create something that approximated a communization international journal, which, as you know, Derek Varn will talk about later, communization being not completely, but very much a sort of French enterprise in the second half of the 20th century. SICK was an attempt to internationalize that with a lot of different groups, Swedish, Greek, British, Anglophone broadly, German, interacting with these theories such as they've come down from the 1968 generation. So without further ado, this is how SICK Journal, including Theory Communiste, Riff Raff, Endnotes, and others, came together to define communization. This is on page 6, entitled Communization. In the course of the revolutionary struggle, the abolition of the division of labor, of the state, of exchange, of any kind of property, the extension of a situation in which everything is freely available as the unification of human activity, that is to say, the abolition of classes, of both public and private spheres, these are all measures, and that's in quotes, for the abolition of capital, imposed by the very need of the struggle against the capitalist class. The revolution is communization. Communism is not its project or result. One does not abolish capital for communism, but by communism, or more specifically, by its production. Indeed, communist measures must be differentiated from communism. They are not embryos of communism, rather they are its production. Communization is not a period of transition, but rather revolution itself is the communist production of communism. The struggle against capital is what differentiates communist measures and communism. The content of revolutionary activity is always the mediation of the abolition of capital by the proletariat in its relation to capital. This activity does not constitute an alternative in competition with the reproduction of the capitalist mode of production, but rather the latter's internal contradiction and its overcoming. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, a whole historical period entered into crisis and came to an end. The period in which the revolution was conceived in different ways, both theoretically and practically, as the affirmation of the proletariat, its elevation to the position of ruling class, the liberation of labor and the institution of a period of transition. The concept of communization appeared in the midst of this crisis. During this crisis, the critique of all the mediations of the existence of the proletariat within the capitalist mode of production, mass parties, unions, parliamentarism, of organizational forms such as the party form or the vanguard, of ideologies such as Leninism, of practices such as militantism in all of its variations, all this appeared irrelevant if revolution was no longer to be the affirmation of a class, whether it be a workers' autonomy or a generalization of workers' councils. It is the proletariat's struggle as a class that has become the problem, i.e. has become its own limit. This is how the class struggle signals and produces the revolution as communization in the form of its overcoming. So then just the ending here. In the contradictory course of the capitalist mode of production since the 1970s, the affirmation of the proletariat and the liberation of labor have lost all meaning and content. There is no longer a worker's identity facing capital and confirmed by it. The revolutionary dynamic of contemporary struggles consists in the act of denial against capital of the proletarian condition, even within ephemeral, limited bursts of self-management or self-organization. The proletariat's struggle against capital contains its contradiction and its own nature as a class of capital. The abolition of capital, i.e. the revolution and the production of communism, is immediately the abolition of all classes and therefore of the proletariat. This occurs through the communization of society, which is abolished as a community separated from its elements. Proletarians abolish capital by the production of a community immediate to its elements. In this way, they transform their relations into immediate relations between individuals, between singular individuals that are no longer the embodiment of a social category, including the supposed natural categories of the social sexes of men and women. Revolutionary practice is the coincidence of the changing circumstances and of human activity, i.e. self-transformation. Thus ends the section on communization here in SICK Volume 1. So that's, I suppose, one large group or a group of groups' self-conception of communization, of what it means, where it comes from, its history, and its self-understanding. Where do you want to go from there? Do you want to continue? Do you want to do a historical sort of examination of communization? Because they kind of reference history, right?
They reference history, and if, honestly, if you don't speak ultra-lefties, you actually have no idea what that means. I'm not, like, I'm just going to be honest. Like,
what I just read, it sounded, I guess if only because I had some experience going back some years, it made some sense to me. Does that sound like wingnut shit to, like, the layperson? Like, have people turned this podcast off already?
I don't know, because you know, the way I translate that statement is that we reject a bunch of things that are considered parts of traditional Marxist thought, and even some things that are considered parts of traditional anarchist thought.
Right.
So one of the things I think they reject is the party form. They reject the idea of a prolonged transition period. They reject programmatism, although that's not unique to communization either. I mean, they reject
the transitionary period.
Yeah, the transitionary period. Some of them reject the idea of workers' identity altogether, although that is not in that statement because they still talk about the necessity of proletarian revolution. But that's something that's going to come up a lot, particularly with the, like, the riot form communists who have the relationship to communization.
Right.
And I think the idea, even if you do accept proletarian revolution, the idea that the workers' conception of themselves is a block to the workers being able to abolish class.
Yeah.
Is, I think, universal to communization theory. Now, I came to this from a variety of places, but I think you do have to understand left communism and some deep history, like some pre-Marxist history, to get to what this emerged out of in France. the word communization is really old. It's actually probably, I think it may actually be older than the word capitalism used in English, believe it or not. But it wasn't translated into English until William Morris, I think in 1893. But the original word comes from Theodore Dazami, I think. Everybody forgive my pronunciation of French. Who was a neo-Babufist, who was considered actually the transitionary figure between early, like, Enragé, radical revolutionary Republicans, and the Blanquist, which are the, like, the French socialist standard of the pre-Marxist period, and Blanquist and Marxist of the late 19th century. He's like an intermediate figure. Go ahead.
This is like the weird interregnum between the full flowering of the bourgeois revolution after Napoleon, but before the July days. Like, this is a sort of a revolutionary understanding of, like, not the, like, maybe the organized sans-culotte, like the early, like, kind of proto-proletarian, would you say?
Yeah. Yeah. This is the organized sans-culotte. This is the beginning of proletarian. And what Dazami saw communization as being is, and he specifically used the term communization of social relations. So he had a very specific definition here. As direct cessation of commerce tied in with a gradual and not immediate abolition of the state. So you have a Marxist concept predating Marx that the abolition of state is necessary, but it's not immediate. But then you have maybe something in Marx and maybe not. I mean, the great debate is about, really comes into a couple of readings of Capital, volumes 1, 2, and 3. And what you think is meant by the remnants of bourgeois society in the Critique of the Goethe program. But this idea that also there is a direct and immediate cessation of all commerce. So markets immediately end. Right. That's Dazami's use of the term. It kind of goes away. It's used in Russian by Peter Kropotkin. And then it's actually used, weirdly, by William Morris. It's the first time it shows up in English. And I think it's when he uses it, he talks about the complete communization of industry for which the economic forms are ready and the minds of the people already prepared. So we have this term comes up 3 times. It's interesting because these are all people who, in the history of Marxism, are considered Marxist adjacent but cannot be called proper Marxist.
Right.
And that term never gets picked up by Marxists. Like, it sort of just goes away.
It's a very useful term, and I think it becomes useful by the second half of the 20th century for groups on the ultra left, specifically in France, but also elsewhere in Europe, because socialization has already come to mean something, maybe non-Marxist, or at least it's come to mean nationalization of property, or the bringing under of various social forms under the purview of the public sphere of the state, right? And so communization all of a sudden posits itself as like the radical rejoinder to a really existing process that's happening in the 20th century, but of course breaking down by the time communization comes back. And this is their self-understanding is working out a problematic that's posed by history in the 1960s and the 1970s, which is the what they understood, what we can maybe call ourselves the death of the classical workers movement. Certainly the decline in strike activity that you see, the breaking up of working class communities, working class mass organizations, working class parties, certainly. And then with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, let's call it, through the 80s and 90s, let's call it, you have then all of a sudden a great opening right? Which gets filled with, I think in the Anglophone world in the United States, it gets filled with a sort of weird progressive anarchism, like one that is specifically anti-electoralist and movementist, but doesn't have programs radically different from progressive capitalist parties or like sort of the left wing of what the possible might be, which is a long-winded way of saying, and I think you can continue your historical exegesis on communization as a term, but like I think what remained attractive about it, not just that it's a snazzy term, communization, but also that it's sort of pointed to paths not taken in the 19th and 20th century and allowed one to be a critic of actually existing socialism without being a Trotskyist, which by the time, you know, the early 21st century comes along is already very much a loaded and kind of dead and sectarian category. I'll let you continue.
Right. I mean, well, communization explicitly comes out of a very specific time in my mind. But even if we look at the term, like historically, we go back to the origins of the term here. It comes out of stalled radical ends of revolutions or when revolutions don't happen. Like when there's not a second revolution to follow up the French Revolution that really goes over well. When Bonapartism becomes the dominant other, you know, response to the failure of the revolution, and the person literally in this case of Napoleon Bonaparte. But I think in general, we can think of Bonapartism as the attempt to embody revolutionary spirits in a singular person in the executive branch. And it happens a lot when revolutions are stalled out for whatever reason. It's a form in my mind of Caesarism, which does not depend on revolution, but it's this idea that you can embody the spirit of a political movement in a man.
Bismarck is obviously one of the huge figures of this, right? And the various you mentioned the Critique of the Goethe program, all the various sort of flirtations that German social democracy had in the 19th century with the state and a conception of socialization, nationalization, regulation, administration of the capitalist economy, which of course Marx and Engels critique, but becomes a sort of dominant mode that has to be accounted for both on both sides of the Iron Curtain by the 20th century.
Right. So I think when we get to communization, we need to understand left communism specifically, even though I will say explicitly, left communists do not consider communization in their tradition anymore. They consider it a deviant thing. In fact, I would tell people, if you want to understand like how the Council Communists understand this, I would read the International Communist Currents 2023 text called The Critique of the So-Called Communizers. I mean, you know, basically the ICC just calls people out, but if you want to understand that perspective, that's what you would want to read probably. But let's talk about what left communism is, because left communism and the left opposition get very, very confused, and they were confused historically too. I mean, Borga was accused of being a Trotskyist, for example. Different forms of liberal adjacent anarchism and some forms of Trotskyism have been very cancelist adjacent at times. People will accuse Rosa Luxemburg's committee of being sort of immediatist and having this orientation. And then when Rosa Luxemburg gets involved with the Spartacus Fund and all that, you know, that's considered a precursor. But left communism specifically are the people who either were kicked out or were criticized in the Third Congress of the Comintern in 1919. The Council Communists, who originally saw themselves as totally aligned with Lenin because they were both on the Zimmerwald left, they leave pretty much immediately and split into various forms of how anti-party they are, from the most anti-party. In fact, someone who even thinks informal communist run unions are too organizational, that's Otto Ruhl, even anarchists critique him for being too anti-organizational, to like the KPD associated with like Karl Korsch, who were splitting with both the independent SPD or the UAPD, I mean the USPD and the socialist part, the SPD proper, and the Communist Party, the KPD. So you got all those weird German acronyms, and so what the KPD was a Communist Workers Party. That would translate to in English. And it's probably the most close to what you would consider like Austro-Marxism and Trotskyism to Otto Ruhl, like I said, who's like so anti-organizational, he can't even be in the councilist-run unions. So there's that. Then there is, and I think this is a historical accident that weirdly modern communization tries to fix, but the Italian left, communist faction, which was founded by Bordiga, who are ultra-Leninist, and they remain ultra-Leninist. They reject the council form. They reject internal democracy altogether. They also do not believe in factionalism, but they completely disagree with purges. Hmm. And they kind of seem to believe that the international should be the governing body of all communists, but it should not be dominated by one state, even a revolutionary successful state like the USSR. So that's the basics of left communism. Left communism in both forms goes into crisis during World War II. Council communism is frankly almost completely eradicated. And I mean, the fascists killed them, and a bunch of other stuff happens. I mean, basically the survivors of that tradition are Jan Appel and Paul Maddox Sr.
Yeah.
And to a lesser degree, Karl Korsch. The Italian ultra left splits into the Dementis. That's the followers of Dement, who was the person maintaining the left faction while Bordiga was in prison, and then Bordiga took a break in politics during the fascist period and only reemerged, I think, in 1949 or 51, somewhere in there. It's after World War II. And when he reemerges, Bordiga accidentally completely resplits the Italian left faction, and so you have the Dementist and the Bordigist, and they're associated with very specific Italian journals. People who call Bordiga, an armchair revolutionary are thinking about this period because he was very active in the 20s with the mainstay of the Communist Party. I mean, he's one of the founders of the Italian Communist Party, which basically is dissolved by the fascists and reconstituted by one of the surviving members of the original, like, three groups that came together to form it, Togliatti, who becomes associated with the Comintern. Anyway, this is the reason why this is important is specifically it is after 68, and a lot of these there are other dissident, would say, left-wing groups who don't have a historical relationship to these two groupings that are left communist. But like the Situationist had a fondness for the council communists, but there's no like organizational line there. Yeah. Similarly with socialism or barbarism, which really pulled from Rosa Luxemburg and Trotsky, but they also had an affinity with the council communist. But there's no direct organizational line. There is a direct organizational line, however, with the Bordigas through Jacques Camat and the French element of the Bordigas Party.
Rest in peace. Passed away last year.
Yep. So, I mean, part of why we're doing this is Joshua Clover and Jacques Camat have both died. So And I'm pretty sure Gilles Duvet is not long for this world.
And well, we're talking about people who kept left communism alive. Of course, Lauren Goldner died last year as well.
Right.
Our friend.
Yeah, your friend and colleague. And my introduction to a lot of this. And so Duvet responds to what he sees as the failures of 68 being put down without a bullet. And he's actually responding to a lot of the same things that, like, more famous people like Jean Baudrillard, who was also a communist, who breaks with that tradition. A lot of the post-Marxist and post-structuralists come out of this frustration with the communist party's relation to the Mitterrand government and to Mitterrand's government's failure to do most of even the socialist things that they promised. And so some of this becomes post-Marxism and Euro-communism, but some of this becomes what becomes the seedbed of a renewed left communism in France. And a response to that renewed left communism in France is Duvet's attempt to resynthesize council communism with the Italian left communism, a tradition that he was associated with, as an answer to the problem. And we have to remember, this is still when the Soviet Union's around. Trotskyism and Maoism are both considered dissident forms of Marxist or of Leninism or Marxist-Leninism that also answer the problems of the Soviet Union. But he sees it, you know, Duvet sees it. He thinks that these are going to fail. And he just seems to have no interest in at all in Maoism. And he also likes the situationist anti-worker politics, but for a completely different reason than they do. And he basically, I think in like 1973, writes what would become the eclipse of reemergence of the communist movement. And he pulls this word from the neo-Babufist, which again, French tradition directly, communization, as what he is going to brand this as, just rejection. He also writes a famous essay about the different forms of dissidence from the Soviet Union. Originally, that essay includes a part on Trotsky that's later redacted. Mm. I will also say Duvet's early works on Bordiga are sloppy. He's wrong about some things. But nonetheless, it's Duvet and then Kamat. Kamat's also a weird figure because he's influential in American anarcho-primitivism at the same time as influential in communization.
Yeah.
So this happens in 68. Go ahead.
No, I was going to add a wrinkle to things too. Mm. And we can play this out as much as we want without smearing any of the Bordigas, post-Bordigas left communist folks as like a priori Holocaust deniers. There is the Forazan affair. I think that's the guy's name, Forazan, around the old Mole bookstore in Paris in the early to mid 1970s. These are left communists who, under the influence of some of Bordiga's writings about the Popular Front and anti-fascism, and also I think in this heady moment, you know, where, as you say, Gilles Duvet is coming up with the Moon Book, the eclipse and reemergence of the communist movement, in this sort of heady moment where 68 seems to smash so many idols, and there's this sort of gazing about for an understanding of this moment in time, it also some section of these groups also break right, and they break towards anti-Semitism, and it's not to tar anybody by saying this is also the moment in time post 1960s when things like the Rassemblement National, right, that like the National Front in France and other groups start to rise and revise, you know, the historiography of World War II, because it's this moment of intense flux. And so I would say, like, positively, of course, there are like the communists that we're talking about, that you're mentioning, were trying to recapitulate something out of this moment, out of this history, to try to revive something from the past, or at least try to understand their present moment using a sort of submerged theoretical apparatus from the workers' movement. But it's part and parcel of a larger, I think, shift away from the sort of understanding of politics and society that arises in what we call the trente glorio, like the 30 glorious years of European growth after the Second World War, when it seemed as though the Keynesian synthesis, the rules-based international order, as we call it now, the Bretton Woods system, and the Marshall Plan were all conspiring to create a moment of prosperity, freedom, individualism across Europe. And of course, this is beginning to fray by the 1970s.
So I do want to talk about the specific Bordiga's origins of negationism, because it is not Bordiga's fault. It's not a position of either faction of the Italian left, but it does emerge out of something Bordiga really believed, which this fascism is no different than any other variant of capitalism, in which he also included social democracy. Weirdly, he was more third period than the third period Soviet Union. I mean, he would say, yeah, of course the social democrats are just like the fascists, because the fascists are just capitalist. Like, and we should treat them no differently and form no popular or united fronts. There is one acceptable united front, and that is a united front from below. So you can, according to Bordiga, form with workers who are not in political parties, who are not communist, but you cannot join with non-communists in political parties, period, end of discussion. And that includes to fight fascists. And so there's a thing attributed to Bordiga but was not written by him called, and the reason why it was misattributed to Bordiga is actually somewhat innocent. Bordiga didn't sign, like, the Bordigist people for a long time, and I still don't, actually, if you read the Internationalist Communist Party, either one of them stuff, they don't sign their articles. So like some of the early Marx stuff, some of the anti-Semitic stuff attributed to Marx outside of, on the Jewish question is actually also not Marx. It's attributed from other people, but they didn't sign their article. So it's just assumed that it might be his. I actually forget the name of the guy, but the guy who wrote Holocaust, a Great Alibi, was actually Jewish, which itself is weird. But that also doesn't deny the Holocaust happened. It just said it was always going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it. United Front was unnecessary. World War II was unnecessary. But that's the position of negationism that emerges on the left. This is a strong thing in France because it rejects the French tradition, the specific French tradition of the Popular Front. Yeah. The Popular Front, as adopted by the Comintern, emerged in France about 3 years before it was adopted and then was picked up in Italy. But if we are honest, if you do the history of it, which I was surprised, I always thought the Popular Front was like a Stalin-era Comintern invention. It is not. It actually goes back to before communism. It's a French Revolutionary tradition thing that gets picked up in 36. It gets eventually adopted by the Comintern after they drop third periodism, after they drop, the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, but then it gets put on hold by the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact because, when you have a detente with the Nazis, it's very hard to have an anti-Nazi Popular Front. And then but it's actually encouraged to be maintained in Italy and in France. And then with the invasion of the USSR by Hitler, it is adopted, formally as a stance. And also, the Comintern is eventually dissolved. So it just becomes the standard position of most Marxist-Leninists around the world. And the reason, what makes this logic interesting, the affair you're talking about actually comes out of Socialism or Barbary. There's other kind of post-situationist ultra-left groups. And I'm going to use ultra-left here because that all these groups were left communist proper, and it's a little confusing. It was with the Organization of Young Workers International or something, wrote a famous essay that I kind of like called Militancy, the Highest Form of Alienation. They also fell into this old mole bookstore thing. So the logic has seemed to go as follows. The Popular Front was a bad idea. The Holocaust was going to happen anyway. Well, the Holocaust is bad enough that it seems like maybe the Popular Front was justified in light of that retroactively. How do we handle that? And some in France in specific go, well, maybe the Holocaust is exaggerated by the Popular Frontist. And then eventually this becomes, maybe it didn't happen at all. Right. And you start seeing a lot of these ultra leftists make common cause with nationalists, and some of them end up, like you said, on the far right. But I wanted to explain there is a logic there that you can read as charitably as you can, yeah, about how each stage went that way. But and it's not unique to Bordigism, but Bordigism was tied into it. So was Jules Duvet. I mean, Duvet is tied into this controversy, yep, as is Jacques Camat. So that all happens.
I could say something, and I'm going to be very careful about what I say, because I believe that the Holocaust happened, and I believe in its and how serious it is, how perverse the idea of like the industrial destruction of an entire group of people based on their ethnicity, religion, nationality, whatever the case may be. I believe that full stop, 100%. That said, one of the things over the last 20 months, and I'm dating that since October 7th, 2023, and the aftermath of that, and partially too, also that overlapping with the experience with the Russo-Ukrainian war, that we have as bystanders or as people receiving wisdom of from the media, from the politicians, from the pundits of these two different wars. It is certainly true that a great edifice was created. And it was, and I'm talking about the post-war order here. I'm talking about the United Nations and all of its subsidiary organizations, the conception of a world in which war was essentially outlawed or at least regulated by an international body that had real teeth to it, that that like the rougher edges of capital accumulation will be sorted out by a strong administrative state, nationally bounded, but also having an international character to it, through the kind of the various different nation states, which capitalist nation states, which compose the international order. That order is breaking down as we speak. We feel it breaking down as we speak. The imposition of that order was an attempt by the victorious Allied powers to make sure that a World War II couldn't happen again. And of course, it became World War III, which was the Cold War. But we right now, I think, can feel as Israel, which is a product of this moment in time, produces its own Holocaust, produces its own genocide in another region of the world. And the alleged like protector of humanity after Auschwitz, which is the United States, not only stands idly by, but on top of that, gives tons of weapons and diplomatic support. It's clear that people in the 1970s were feeling as though there was a whole order, like an incipient, a capitalist order that was contained within this moment of the Second World War, that the product of that served as a impediment to the independence, the autonomy of the working class as a political and economic subject on the revolutionary terrain. And they're not wrong about that, right? That's not an excuse to go into negationism, but I think that we could see like maybe the rational kernel in the critique of the way in which World War II and its horrors were used to tamp down on any expectations that a post-war order might be something greater than an Iron Curtain and an administrative state and social democracy patterned upon the New Deal in the United States, that would ultimately feel more and more insufficient for revolutionaries as the 1950s, 60s, and 70s progressed. Does that all make right. sense? I,
yes.
I, yeah. I hope I was.
I'm gonna be the Anglo brain person and break down the historiographic controversies there and interpretation of the Holocaust. There's negationism, which we already mentioned. There's outright Holocaust denial, which some negationists turn into, so denialism. But there's two kind of main historiographic positions that are accepted, even amongst the leftists and the right. Intentionalism, which has been picked up by Zionists and a lot of the West, that there was always a master plan to exterminate all the Jews. This was the whole purpose. And functionalism, which is actually Nazi bureaucracy and both internal and external radicalizations of politics taken by various institutions and individuals led to an escalation of violence against Jews and other groups without an overarching plan. There were exterminationists early on in the thing, but that was not actually generally accepted by German society. And that was how you got more and more buy-in. There's two kinds of functionalists. There are right-wing functionalists. That's Ernst Nolte and the like, Daryl What's-His-Face of Martyr Maids, actually probably one of these guys. And right-wing functionalists say it's just the same as with all national formations. I happen to actually agree with that. Mm-hmm. But thus, it's not that big a deal. Mm-hmm. Like, it's bad. It's a historical tragedy. It shouldn't have happened. But all nations have done it. And there's left-wing functionalists who go, oh, this is a horrific logic of nation building, both under capital and before. So you got a similar, yes, all nations do this. This is bad. This is why you should be very careful about nationalism. That's right. Arno Mar, you know, why the heavens did not open. There are sub debates in that. But like, basically those are your four positions: denialism, negationism, intentionalism, which is like the Holocaust. The intentionalists also will go, so the Holocaust is totally unique. There's nothing like it in history. So that's the Zionist claim, and a lot of even religious Jewish claims. I grew up around Schulz that believe this crap.
And I
say crap. I'm going to let my opinion be known. I also think intentionalism's nutty, even though I do think, yes, there was members of the Nazi party who really did want to exterminate all the Jews for early on. I think you can't say that they were initially the dominant force in the party. Or in German society in general. But I also don't want to like pretend that absolves Germany of what happened because it's a normal nation building process. If anything, to me, it indicates how horrific we need to actually look at the nation. But I mean, you know, I got in trouble in college, even when I was a right winger, when someone told me the Holocaust is unique. And I was like, well, there's still a higher percentage of Jews left in the world than most tribes of indigenous people in North America. Just want to point that out.
Right.
Like,
it's not, the argument is not a quantitative one. Ultimately, it's a qualitative one, right? That there's something to the industrial process. There's something to the dehumanization process. There's something about, and you'll always hear this trotted out, that Germany was like the most advanced society culturally in the entire world in the 1920s and 1930s, and then they devolved into this murderous, genocidal, ideological take. This, of course, like the fact of the Holocaust is important and interesting, and I think that you're right to point out that there is like differing historiography on this, because obviously it's grandness, its greatness as a historical event, or its sublimity, its awesomeness as a historical event, will rocket through history, which is what's interesting about it to us, I think, which is ultimately how it's perceived and how it's not just we perceive it, because maybe we're not that important, but how our rulers conceived it, starting at the end of the Second World War when a new order was put together. But also the growing importance of it, and you know, this is what somebody like Finkelstein, my neighbor, talked about with the Holocaust industry, as he called it. I'm not sure. I don't call it that. I don't come down really one side or the other on this whole thing. But it is true that the Holocaust only becomes important by the 1960s and 1970s. And this is the sort of the milieu, like the environment, the ambient environment in which these debates that you're talking about are happening. As it takes 25 years or so for society writ large, global society, to come to terms with this, it also becomes at the same time a way of justifying or a way of shielding, I think, the post-war order from a certain degree of criticism. It's like, oh, well, there are Hitler particles. I was tickled to find out that it's Trotsky that came up with the idea of Hitler particles. But there's Hitler particles in every person, in every society. There's like a Holocaust waiting to happen. And if you don't have liberal democracy, if you don't have a rules-based international order, United Nations, a World Bank, an IMF, then you're just waiting for the next Hitler to arise. This, I think, is the fascinating thing for us to experience at this moment. But maybe we're a little far afield from communization at this point in time.
We are, but I do think you have, like, this is one of the theory, the controversies of which French left communism and communization are highly, highly tied into. I want to, like, talk about communization now modernly, and then we can talk about our relation to it. I think the groups I associate with is communization. When Jules Devey published his Eclipse and Reemergence of the Communist Movement, the so-called Moon Book, it was initially published by an anarchist press in 1974 in Detroit. And it kind of stayed in a very particular ultra-left college milieu, and like nobody read it. Like, then there was the Critique of the Situationist International, published, I think, a little later, also published by a small anarchist press, mostly as a pamphlet. Nobody read it. In 1983, What is Communism and What is Situationism was published in London in English by Unpopular Books. More people read it in Europe, but they're closer to France. Makes sense, you know. And that starts a lot of the, let's say, the precursors to the second wave of communization that you and I know, like Aufhebung and a lot of these like theoretical journals in Europe that are also tied into Value Form Critique in Germany in the 90s. And in America, we didn't get any of that shit. Like, I'm just gonna, like, it. Like, yeah. Lauren Goldner and Ken Nabb are the only reason any of us might have heard of any of this before the late aughts. And I'm going to tell you why the form of communization that was first read about America and it became popular in America is not the form of communization we're talking about. But I do think it's why we talk about communization at all, as my understanding of these events is, the anarchist wing of communization around, when anarchist is kind of not the right word, but I don't really know else how to talk about it, because it does come out of insurrectionary anarchism, picking up some of these ideas by Duvet, but going in a completely different direction and tying more post-structuralism in it.
Post-situ, I think.
Yeah, post-situationist. Yeah. And that is HOTIS, the Invisible Committee, and Tocoon. And the reason why we know about them is they were published by a post-structuralist press, Semiotics.
Semiotics, yeah.
Yeah. That was mostly also publishing like Baudrillard's minor text and stuff by Bifo and the Eurocommunist and some of the early Autonomia stuff, which has some relationship to this, but I'm not going to go into that. Italy and France comes up over and over again. Glenn Beck,
yes,
picked up this obscure translation of a French communist thing and used it for anti-Obama conspiracy theories, yeah, which then propelled Tocoun and the Invisible Committee to be read by college students everywhere at the time that a lot of this, I'm going to call David Graeberite, but that's not really fair to David Graeber because it predates him, but this like quasi-liberal form of anarchism that came out of ZNet and Chomsky Mags and Ab Busters was running out of steam, but seeming to reemerge after the whatever the hell the United Front Against the Iraq War was fading. And this sort of was in the background to that. So people who were reading David Graeber and Chomsky started reading Cocoon and the Invisible Committee. They were also reading Agamben and Baudrillard and all these things in grad school.
And I will point out that, you know, my initial experience of this is 2008, let's say, there was a guerrilla reading of The Coming Insurrection at a Barnes and Nobles on Union Square in Manhattan, New York. I did not attend it, but it made a huge splash because it was local. I'd call them insurrectionaries, kind of post situ sort of what you're describing, like Agamben-esque sort of that intersection between anarchism and communism, anarcho-communism, insurrectionary anarchism, Marxist anarchism, whatever you want to call it. That was that had a sort of symbiotic relationship with Glenn Beck, in that Glenn Beck would have one of his Blackboard sessions and point to The Coming Insurrection and connect it to Acorn and Barack Obama. And then you'd have a guerrilla reading of The Coming Insurrection and it would get coverage on Fox News and Glenn Beck would talk about it the next night. So there was a way in which like it already appeared on our shores as a sort of golem, as a sort of object of fascination and revulsion by like American political society, which gave it, I think, of course, like a real imprimatur among radicals in 2008, 2009. As you said, as the protests against the global war on terror by the time 2007, 2008 comes along, becomes necessarily takes on a more economistic cast because we have the great financial crisis.
Right. And we also have to remind ourselves that this is also after the years of debate and the what I call it neo-anarchism, because outside of the IWW, it neither David Graeber nor Maury Bookchin, actually Bookchin comes out of a Trotskyist milieu and had relationship to the Situationist, and Bob Black and the Primitivist actually also have relationship to this French 70s radical stuff. They like Searson was trying to combine Kamat and Adorno and his own theories about hunter-gatherer anarchism.
Yeah.
And that becomes a dominant form of radicalism. Like Derek Jensen is a name that because of his anti-trans stance, we don't talk about anymore, but like he was in every Barnes and Nobles. Daniel Quinn, who wrote Ishmael. Go ahead.
You're supposed to be talking to the salmon, talking to the forest. You were supposed to be abolishing language. You were supposed to be returning. He was. And then of course in the WTO protests, in 1999, these theories, these anarcho-primitivist theories also got a little bit of notoriety throughout the country and was oftentimes, I think, if you were of a earlier period, time period like myself and probably you, since we're about the same age, might have been your first kind of opening up to a radical theoretical milieu and practical milieu, which was like deep green resistance of the Pacific right. North. And primitivism.
It was part of what I was responding to that made me a paleo conservative. I'm not going to lie. Like, I thought all that stuff was crazy. And I remember I came out of zine culture too, like specifically zine culture. And I remember I was like 18 and hitting on the debates between Bookchin and Bob Black in zines, like not directly. I wasn't reading direct stuff. It was people talking about it in zines, like in the footnotes when they're also talking about records. I don't want to make it like the, I don't want to make it sound like this was like the predominant thing, but it became bigger and bigger, particularly as like the people tried to write the anarchist fact, which I think you can buy as a book now, and stuff like that. What I now know, though, and I bring this out, and we talked about this, I call it neo-anarchism because basically between the liquidation of the IWW into the TUEL and the TUUL, which was the William C. Foster's Comintern-aligned labor movement, and the stalling of the IWW literally for like three generations, the only person popular on the anarchist left in the United States who has any relationship whatsoever to the historical anarchist movements in Europe are the United States was Chomsky. And as early as the 70s, he was doing this anarchist popular front crap.
Yeah.
So, like,
anarchist popular front, that's a really good way to put it, right? That right. is, I think maybe we flatter ourselves by assuming that that's not the kind of dominant ideology of the left nowadays. I think it is. I think that actually maybe one of the reasons why communization became an attractive ideology for people like me and to you to some extent too, is because it was a way to try to break out of the sort of 80s and 90s and 2000s Chomsky.info sort of anarcho-popular frontism, which prevails all the way up till this period. I feel like voting for Biden to stop the fascist Trump and street mobilizations, which are calling for socialism, communism, anarchism, or whatever at the resistance rallies to Donald Trump. We maybe
paid
have
for a- by Walmart heiresses, but yeah.
Say again?
Paid for partially by Walmart heiresses. Yes.
Right. Well, there's your popular front, right? Yeah. So anyways, this was a dominant political form. It may still be. I don't know. I never know how much when I leave my particular milieu, when I leave the ILC or the Carpenters Union, what the left even looks like, because I'm not convinced that the left as it exists on Blue Sky, Twitter, or Facebook is really the actually existing left. I don't know.
Yeah. We'll talk about this and we'll talk about like my critiques of all this in a while, but I want to talk about my personal history and you can talk about yours. And so,
yeah, let's do that. But let's, we're at like about an hour now, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to move to the paywall now and then we'll talk about personal histories and whatnot.
Yeah. Let's move to the paywall. So let's,
if you're enjoying what you hear here, you can, get the second half of this conversation, which should prove to be long and interesting, by becoming a patron either of The Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada, or you can watch this on video. You can watch our lovely faces and our gesticulations on patreon.com/VarnVlog. Special bonus, you could do both. I'm not even sure it gets you anything extra, but you could just do both to support the work that we're both doing. But thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you on the other side.